Will you be able to hear me okay in the back of the room? Can you hear up there? Good. It's a great pleasure for me to be back in the Netherlands. My previous two visits here were in 1950 and in 1959, and my 1959 visit ended inauspiciously when, taking a walk at night on a crowded street, I thought it would be less dangerous if I stepped down from the street onto the sidewalk, and what I stepped into was instead a canal. It took me 41 years to overcome now that traumatic reintroduction to the Netherlands. Nevertheless, I feel as if I've been working on the fringe of the Netherlands since 1979, when I began working in what is now Indonesian New Guinea, or Papua, and what for a long time was Dutch New Guinea, and working in Indonesia. My work in New Guinea and Indonesia has meant reading the books and the accounts of Dutch explorers and Dutch ornithologists. I've learned just enough Dutch so that I can make my way through these early accounts. And it's a pleasure to be back here under these circumstances, a pleasure to be here as the guest of the John Adams Institute, and a pleasure to be here at the time when my book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, is being released in Dutch by Het Spectrum under the title of, and now listen to my impeccable Dutch accent, Zwaarden, Paarden, en Ziekte Kiemen. Another reason for my pleasure in being here this evening is, of course, that I get to discuss with you the most interesting and important question about human history, namely why human history unfolded differently on different continents. You're going to hear that my answers are geographic answers, and that's another reason for my pleasure in being here. In some countries, people are suspicious about stressing the role of geography in human history. I can't imagine any country where the importance of geography is better understood than in the Netherlands. You look at a map of Europe, and right away you understand the issues in the history of the Netherlands. The specific question that I'll address then is why history unfolded differently for different peoples. For example, as I look out at you this evening, it looks to me as if most, nearly all of you, are of Eurasian origin. Why did history turn out that way? Why was it not the case that Aboriginal Australians or Native Americans came to Europe, killed, infected, exterminated most of the original Dutch, and drove the last surviving Dutch to live on small, undesirable islands off in the Ostsee? It didn't happen that way. When I lecture in Los Angeles, again, most of my audience consists of people of Eurasian origin, yet 500 years ago in Los Angeles, everybody there would have been of Native American origin. Why did history happen that way rather than the reverse way? This is the biggest, broadest question of history. It's a question that professional historians tend to ignore. And I think part of the reason is that the answer to this question now proves to come from fields of knowledge remote from history. The answer depends upon technical details of genetics, molecular biology, linguistics, archaeology, plant biochemistry, animal behavior, epidemiology, discoveries of the last 10 or 20 years. The subtitle of the British edition of my book, I think, well summarizes what it's about. The subtitle seemed too humorous for my American editor, and I noticed that the subtitle has also not been adopted for the Dutch edition, but it does well summarize the book. The British subtitle is A Short History of Everybody for the Last 13,000 Years. So the text of the book is 420 pages long. you can easily calculate 420 pages, 5 continents, 13,000 years, 130 centuries. That means that on the average, I can devote 2/3 of a page of my book to the history of one continent for one century. And that makes it clear that I had to omit some details about human history in order to fit it all into 420 pages. This evening, I will try to summarize it all for you in 45 minutes. And therefore, I will have to omit even more details. Nevertheless, I hope this evening to hit the most important things about what happened in history and to provide explanations for them. As background at the beginning, just remind you that I'll be talking about apparently abstract things like human societies, competition, and history, but what we're really talking about is the fates of individual people like you and me. I'm going to begin by scrolling through slides, portraits of people from different parts of the world, just so you can remind yourself that we're talking about the fates of real people. I'm not going to comment on these portraits. I will just go through them one after another, just to remind you of real people. So could we have the... Thank you. Could we have the lights down on the first... A convenient starting point for our discussion is to recognize the differences among different parts of the world in their homogeneity or heterogeneity of human populations. There are some parts of the world where lots of very different people live together within a short distance, and there are other parts of the world where everybody is very similar over large distances. Areas that are particularly heterogeneous include the Indian subcontinent, with 1,000 different languages and very different looking people, genetic diversity. My beloved New Guinea, with again 1,000 languages, enormous genetic and cultural diversity. Aboriginal Australia, with again 260 different languages, people very different in their appearance. And Sub-Saharan Africa, perhaps the most diverse continent of all. These heterogeneous parts of the globe contrast with homogeneous areas. For example, tropical Southeast Asia, from the Malay Peninsula through the Philippines, Indonesia, out to Polynesia. Everybody looks similar to each other, like this Polynesian woman, and all their languages are closely related to each other, and all the people are genetically similar over this distance of nearly 12,000 kilometers. Or Europe, while some people in Europe are blue-eyed blondes, for example, here, and others are dark-eyed and black-haired, as in Italy. Apart from that, there really is very little difference among Europeans. Genetically, most Europeans speak closely related languages. Europeans are rather similar culturally. Europe is homogeneous. Again, Native Americans, all Indians of both North America and South America, very similar to each other in their genetics and physical appearance. We can now have the lights on again and the slides off for a while. And what can be called black sub-equatorial Africa. All peoples of Africa, if you take away the Khoisan people and the Pygmies, the black Bantu-speaking African farmers are very similar to each other. Thank you. We could have the lights full up now. Okay. Why these differences? Why are some areas heterogeneous and others homogeneous? Is it just a matter of time? Is it that the parts of the globe where humans arrived most recently, there just hasn't been time to evolve much genetic and linguistic diversity? That time factor could explain why the peoples of the New World are so homogeneous. The New World was the last continents to be colonized by people, probably only about 13,000 years ago, so there just hasn't been time to evolve much genetic or physical diversity among North American and South American Indians. But the time factor certainly doesn't explain some of these other examples that I've been giving you. For example, the famous fossils of Java man, or maybe she actually was Java woman. whether Java man or Java woman, show us that people have been on the tropical island of Java in Indonesia for at least a million, maybe nearly 2 million years. Why, after all that time, is everybody from the Malay Peninsula out to Easter Island over those 12,000 kilometers so similar? There's been plenty of time to evolve genetic diversity. Or Europe, again, the famous fossil of Heidelberg man, or maybe she was Heidelberg woman, tell us that people have been in Europe for at least 600,000 years, maybe longer. Why, after all that time, are Europeans still so similar to each other in their genes and their languages? Or Africa, the cradle of humanity. Africa is the continent where people have been for the longest time. People evolved in Africa beginning about 5 million years ago. Why, after all this time, are all the black farmers of sub-equatorial Africa so similar to each other in appearance and in language? By contrast, New Guinea and Australia have been occupied for only about 60,000 years, and yet there's tremendous genetic diversity in New Guinea and Australia, far greater than after 600,000 years in Europe or after 1.5 million years in tropical Southeast Asia or after 5 million years in Africa. Either something must have happened to promote rapid genetic diversification of the peoples of Australia and New Guinea, or else something happened recently to homogenize the peoples of Europe and of tropical Southeast Asia and of black sub-equatorial Africa. It turns out that the correct explanation is the latter explanation. The populations of Europe and tropical Southeast Asia and black sub-equatorial Africa were homogenized recently within the last 10,000 years by the so-called agricultural expansions. And there just hasn't been enough time since that recent restirring of the pot to re-evolve much diversity in Europe or Southeast Asia or Africa. What do I mean by the agricultural expansions? 12,000 years ago, 13,000 years ago, everybody everywhere in the world was a hunter-gatherer, gaining their living by hunting animals, wild animals, and gathering wild foods. Hunter-gatherer societies are mostly nomadic. They move around, changing base every few days or every few weeks to follow the seasonally shifting food supply. And hunter-gatherers live at low population densities, one person per square kilometer or much less. Gatherers are at low densities, partly because most of the plants and animals out there are not edible to us humans, so there's just not much food there for a hunter-gatherer. But also because if you're a hunter-gatherer woman and you're going to be moving camp every few weeks, you can't afford to have two babies within a four-year span. You can't move camp until your second youngest child can walk fast enough to keep up with the group. And so hunter-gatherer women space out their children at intervals of 4 years. Only when the previous child has reached the age of 4 years and can keep up with the group can a hunter-gatherer woman have another child. So that's why hunter-gatherers have low population densities. Hunter-gatherers don't produce much in the way of storable food surpluses. They hunt and they gather their food each day. And because they don't have stored food surpluses, they don't have food. Every adult in a hunter-gatherer society spends part of every day going out and hunting or gathering food. That means that there are not food surpluses that can be used to feed people who won't procure their own food, but will sit home spending all their time figuring out how to smelt iron or make pottery or design riding systems or atomic bombs. In addition, if you're going to move camp every 3 weeks, the last thing you want is a printing press or a whole collection of pots or an atomic bomb to carry with you. So there we have two reasons why the technology of hunter-gatherers has always been simple, why no hunter-gatherer society ever developed metal tools. In addition, the fact that hunter-gatherers don't have storable food surpluses meant that hunter-gatherer societies were egalitarian. Everybody, every adult was out there gathering food, so there were no full-time chiefs or kings or priests or bureaucrats or these other parasites upon society. who eat the food gathered by other people and then sit home and say, I'm your boss and I'll eat your food. All of those things about hunter-gatherer societies changed with the advent of agriculture about 10,000 years ago. Agriculture, for the first time in human history, permitted lots of people to live, settle down in permanent villages next to their permanent gardens and orchards and pastures. The adoption of agriculture resulted in a population explosion. Out there in that wheat field or in that pasture, all of the plants and all of the animals are edible to us humans. Much higher density of food, so the population densities of farmers are 100, 1,000 people per square kilometer, as you know very well in Holland. And in addition, farmers, because they're living settled in a village, they don't have this problem of carrying the babies with them when they shift camp. And so a farmer woman can afford to have babies more often than every 4 years. The birth spacing among traditional farmer societies drops from the 4 years of hunter-gatherers to about 2 years. There are two reasons then for the enormous population explosion associated with farming. In addition with farming, a modest number of farmers, peasant farmers, can produce enough food that can be stored to feed people who don't have to spend any time producing food for themselves. And so those stored food supplies can be used to feed people who will spend all their time sitting there figuring out how to smelt iron and how to make pottery and how to devise riding systems and ultimately how to build guns. In addition, that stored food is a temptation. It's a temptation for some particularly enterprising farmer to say, hi folks, I'm going to be your new boss, your chief, your king, your priest. I'm not going to go out there raising food like you peasants, and then instead that stored food will serve me and my bureaucrats and my tax collectors and my priests. And in return for that, I'm going to render you folks services. We're going to organize this community. I'm going to govern you. And among other things, we're going to organize an army, and we're going to go kill the people next door. And in addition, if you folks revolt, that army is there to kill you guys too. So the development of farming meant the appearance of socially stratified societies with technological specialists and with centralized political power. We now have a whole series of reasons why farmers can kill or drive out hunter-gatherers in any area suitable for farming. First of all, the farmers are at much higher population densities, 100 or 1,000 farmers for every hunter-gatherer. Secondly, the farmers have much more advanced technology. Initially, copper swords, and then bronze swords, and steel swords, and guns, and finally atomic bombs. And the farmers also have a centralized political organization with a chief or a king who can go organize the attack, and a priest who can say, I absolve you and those heathens, it's okay to go kill those heathens next door, and in fact, it's good to do it. Those are the reasons, then, why human history for the last 13,000 years has consisted of a succession of farmers driving out, killing, infecting hunter-gatherers over all parts of the world suitable for farming. We've seen it in modern times, since the year 1492. We've seen it as European farmers have exterminated or conquered the native hunter-gatherers of Australia and of the Western North America and the San hunter-gatherers of Southern Africa and the native Siberians. But these conquests of hunter-gatherers by farmers began much earlier in human history. Since farming provided so much power for the first farmers, it's initially surprising why didn't hunter-gatherers in any part of the world go out and domesticate some of the plants and animals around them and become farmers and thereby gain an advantage over neighboring people. For example, why didn't some Aboriginal Australians go out and domesticate kangaroos and start growing eucalyptus trees and become farmers and conquer other hunter-gatherer Aboriginal Australians? This question becomes especially paradoxical when you think of the areas of the modern world that are the most productive areas for agriculture today. None of the areas of productive agriculture in the world today were areas where agriculture developed independently. And that especially should interest you people from the Netherlands, because I believe that the most intensive productive agriculture in the world today is in the Netherlands and some other parts of Europe. And yet agriculture never arose spontaneously in the Netherlands. It was brought in from the outside. Obviously, the Netherlands is ideal land for agriculture. Why didn't the original inhabitants of the Netherlands develop agriculture for themselves? In the United States, the centers of agriculture are California, where I live, and the Great Plains. Again, no independent origins of agriculture. No independent origins of agriculture in Java, one of the most densely populated farming societies, in the Indian subcontinent, teeming with peasant farmers today, in the Cape of South Africa, in the wheat belt of Australia. All these centers of modern farming had no independent origins of agriculture. They acquired it from elsewhere. The reason for this paradox is that the agricultural lifestyle, as it developed, had to compete with the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And the first farmers could outcompete the hunter-gatherers only if the first farmers had a whole package of productive crops and animals to encourage them to settle down and become farmers. But it turns out that only a tiny fraction of the wild plants and animal species around the world are suitable for domestication. And very few areas of the world, at most 9 areas, maybe as few as 5 areas of the world, had enough wild plant and animal species suitable for domestication for farming to start there independently. This paradox is clearest when you look at domestic mammals. There are 4,000 species of mammals around, wild mammals around the world. Every continent, even Australia, has hundreds of wild mammals. So why didn't the people of every continent go out and domesticate mammals and become herdsmen? Why didn't Aboriginal Australians domesticate kangaroos and koala bears? Of the 14 most important large domestic mammal species of the world today, 13 of them are derived from Eurasian, European or Asian wild ancestors. Those 13 valuable wild mammals derived from Eurasia are the cow, sheep, goat, pig, horse, the reindeer, the donkey, the Arabian camel, the Bactrian camel, the yak, the water buffalo, the gaur, the bantang. There's only one large wild mammal that was domesticated in the New World. Can anyone think of that one big mammal domesticated in the New World? Llama. Somebody's read my book. That's correct. The llama, the only wild mammal, the llama and alpaca, breeds of the same animal, the only large wild mammal domesticated in the New World. What was the matter with all those other big mammals of the New World? It turns out that for a wild mammal to be domesticated, it has to possess at least 6 different characteristics. And the vast majority of wild mammal species are derailed by lacking one or another of those characteristics. For example, you obviously cannot domesticate and grow an animal whose food, whose diet you cannot supply. But koalas of Australia are finicky eaters that eat only the leaves of certain eucalyptus trees. So it's hard for even your enterprising Dutch farmers or Aboriginal Australians to go feed koalas. Again, no farmer, not even your very patient Dutch farmers, are going to have the patience to grow a barnyard animal that grows very slowly and isn't ready for the slaughterhouse until 20 years. And so your patient Dutch farmers have chosen not to grow gorillas, which otherwise would be a fabulous food production animal. What Dutch farmer will wait 20 years until his or her barnyard gorilla is ready to kill and send to the slaughterhouse? You would rather have an animal that's ready to send off in a year or two. Again, farmers are not going to domesticate animals which, when they're old enough to go to the slaughterhouse, are more likely to slaughter you than you to slaughter it. And so I recognize that your Dutch farmers are strong and courageous, but nevertheless, they never domesticated your brown bear, which would be a fabulous food production animal, because brown bears will eat almost any garbage, and they grow to full size in a few years, but they have a nasty disposition. You can't domesticate an animal that refuses to breed in captivity. Cheetahs, which would have been great hunting animals, vicuña of the Andes, which would have had the world's best wool. They won't breed in captivity and couldn't be domesticated. Animals which don't have a follow-the-leader social structure, animals which, when you pen them in, panic and jump over the fence or bash over the fence, again, can't be domesticated. The result is that only about 14 species of big mammals were domesticated around the world, and 13 of them happened to be Eurasian, one from America, none from sub-Saharan Africa or Australia. Surprisingly, one consequence of this is that the acute crowd infectious diseases of humans, the diseases by which European people killed most Native Americans, infected and killed most Native Americans and Aboriginal Australians, diseases like smallpox and measles and mumps and flu and pertussis, these diseases now confined to humans evolved from diseases of our domestic animals. Flu evolved from a disease of pigs, measles evolved from a disease of cattle, tuberculosis from a disease of cattle, pertussis from a disease of pigs, but the most domestic mammals were in Eurasia. So Eurasians evolved these nasty germs to which they themselves became partly immune, and they then transmitted these nasty germs to Aboriginal Australians, Native Americans who had no immunity and died in huge numbers. Surprisingly, it's also the case for plants as well. This initially really comes as a surprise. There are 200,000 species of higher plants in the world. Every continent, even Australia, has tens of thousands of wild plant species. So why didn't people anywhere, even Aboriginal Australians, go out and domesticate some wild plants and become farmers? Again, most wild plants, for various reasons, cannot be domesticated. And those that can are distributed very unevenly around the globe. For example, consider the lard-seeded grasses, cereals that provide more than half of the calories of people today, the cereals that include wheat and barley and rice and corn. Around the world, there are only 56 wild species of lard-seeded cereals. And of those 56 species, 32 were confined to the Mediterranean zone of Western Asia and Eastern Europe. So, of course, the people of that Mediterranean zone had a huge head start on farming. In their territory grew the ancestors of emmer wheat, einkorn wheat, barley, and the hybrid partner of bread wheat. In fact, the first agriculture and herding arose around 8500 BC in the part of the world known today as the Fertile Crescent, that crescent-shaped band of land extending through parts of what today are Iran, Iraq, Syria, southeastern Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel. That area happened to be the place where there grew the wild ancestors of wheats and barley, peas, lentils, flax, chickpeas, cow, sheep, goat, pig, and nearby horse. So within a short time, hunter-gatherers of the Fertile Crescent assembled the most valuable package of crops and animals that the world has ever seen. And around the same time, or soon thereafter, hunter-gatherers in China domesticated millets and rice and chickens and pigs and water buffalo and became farmers. Later, farming arose independently in the highlands of New Guinea and in Ethiopia and Africa's Sahel zone and tropical West Africa, and in the New World in the southeastern United States, Mexico, and the Andes. But those nine places that I've named are the only even possible places for the independent origins of agriculture. Agriculture spread everywhere else in the world from those nine homelands. And in particular, agriculture never rose independently in Europe, California, Australia, South Africa, etc. As for the spread of agriculture, in some cases, agriculture and herding spread as a result of the crops and animals themselves spreading and being adopted by hunter-gatherers who settled down and became farmers. That happened, for example, in southern Africa, where the original Khoisan people of southern Africa, the so-called Hottentots and Bushmen, acquired cattle and sheep and goats from the north and became herders themselves. Usually, though, the hunter-gatherers never had a chance to become farmers or herders. What instead happened was that the farmers and herders from these nine homelands spread out themselves, carrying their crops and animals with them, overrunning, killing, exterminating, infecting the hunter-gatherers. And so farming and herding usually spread as a result of the spread of the farmers and herders themselves. My last slide, please. This last slide will illustrate an interesting way in which crops and animals spread around the world. Look at this map of the world. This is completely familiar to you. There's one thing on this map that I never thought of until I got to work on my book, Zwarden, Parden, and Zietekenen. And that is, look at the shapes of the continents. The Eurasian continent, long from west to east, narrow from north to south. That's to say, the major axis of Eurasia is east-west. The Americas, long from north to south, narrow from east to west. Major axis of the Americas, north-south. Africa, similarly, major axis, north-south. Okay, this is cute, pretty. Does it mean anything for human history? Yes, it meant a huge amount. It meant that plants and animals domesticated in any part of Eurasia could spread for thousands of miles, always remaining at the same latitude, encountering the same seasonality, day length, climates, diseases, and habitats. And so when crops and animals were domesticated in one part of Eurasia, they often spread rather rapidly to other parts, enriching the agriculture of those other parts. For example, when wheat was domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, wheat spread to Greece in 7,000 BC. And a mere 1,500 years later, the hunting people in Holland had adopted wheat and barley and cows and sheep and had settled down to become farmers and herders using those Fertile Crescent crops and animals. And the horses domesticated in the Ukraine, within a couple of thousand years, they had spread to France and Holland, and they had spread east all the way to China and Japan, enriching the economies of these other parts. In contrast, in the New World and Africa, with that north-south axis, crops and animals could not spread far without encountering climates and day lengths to which they were not adapted. And as a result, the llama domesticated in the Andes never spread the mere 1,500 kilometers to Mexico. The turkey domesticated in Mexico never spread to the Andes. Mexican Indians invented the wheel. Andean Indians domesticated the llama. But the wheel never spread to the Andes and the llama never spread to Mexico. So there was never any wheel transport in the New World. The wheel never met the draft animal because of that north-south axis. In modern times, the ingredients of success for farmers over hunter-gatherers can be summarized in that metaphorical title of my book, Zwarden, Parden, and Zietekenen. Those are metaphors for the advantages of farmers over hunter-gatherers. But ancient farmers possessed advantages too. And the result has been a massive population replacement over the last 10,000 years of farmers replacing hunter-gatherers. That's what homogenized the population of Europe and of tropical Southeast Asia and of black sub-equatorial Africa. As a result, 90% of the people in the world today speak languages of language families that 10,000 years ago were confined to two tiny areas, either the Fertile Crescent or China. If you could have looked at a linguistic map of the world 10,000 years ago, here are these two small areas, Fertile Crescent and China. All the languages spoken anywhere else have either disappeared or are today spoken only by 10% of the world's population. And everybody else speaks languages derived from the Fertile Crescent or China. For example, the Dutch language and the English language and the German language, as well as Italian and Russian. Those are all languages of the Indo-European language family, which arose either in or somewhere near the Fertile Crescent and spread over Europe, east to India, not because the languages were especially beautiful, which I can't claim for English, but because those were the languages of the first farmers who replaced the hunter-gatherers of Europe and India. Among the replacements of hunter-gatherers by farmers in ancient times, we've seen in the last 500 years, European farmers replace the hunter-gatherers of the American West and Aboriginal Australia. there were similar replacements in ancient times that archaeologists have studied. The clearest cases are cases in which the immigrant farmers and the indigenous hunter-gatherers were very unlike each other, so you can recognize the differences. One example is the so-called Austronesian expansion. Farmers from the coast of South China began to expand 4,000 BC, 6,000 years ago, into Taiwan, then the Philippines, then Indonesia, Malay Peninsula, out into the Pacific to Polynesia. And that's why everybody in that vast area today speaks Austronesian languages and looks very similar, because the clock was reset by that Chinese farmer expansion of 4,000 BC. Those Chinese farmers, if you could have come to Indonesia 6,000 years ago, the people of Indonesia would have looked like modern New Guineans or Aboriginal Australians, but they were largely replaced by Chinese farmers. Or again, in sub-equatorial Africa, the reason why after 7 million years, all the black farmers of sub-equatorial Africa look the same and speak similar languages, Bantu languages, is that beginning around 3000 BC, black farmers with crops domesticated in West Africa began to expand east, reaching Kenya and Tanzania around 2,000 years ago, and then in one or two centuries spread all the way from the equator south to South Africa. And that rapid recent expansion replaced over all of sub-equatorial Africa the original hunter-gatherers, except in the two areas where black farming would not work, in the Congo rainforest and in the Mediterranean zone and deserts of southern Africa. That's the reason why all the black farmers of southern Africa look similar, because they shared a common ancestor 2,000 years ago. Well, usually when one thinks about this subject of why some people conquered other people, often one falls back on racist explanations. When I ask people in the United States, why do you think that Europeans conquered Aboriginal Australians or Native Americans? Here's the answer that I get, and within the past few months, I've gotten this answer from cabinet ministers and from leaders of American industry and from American university professors. It's not just ignorant people who say this, but the most educated people. They'll say, well, I know this isn't politically correct. I don't like to say this, but let's face it, let's say it. It's because Europeans were smarter than all those other people, and they had the work ethic and the Judeo-Christian tradition. And people will say this, although there's not the slightest bit of evidence for Europeans and Asians having any genetic superiority in intelligence over other people. The reason that people fall back on these racist explanations of history's biggest pattern is that historians have not told us what the correct explanation is. And so, of course, people fall back on the most transparent interpretation. People look different in their skins and hair color, so we assume that perhaps they're also different inside their brains, and maybe that's why Europeans conquered these other people. In fact, it's clear that the European conquest was nothing more than the culmination of historical processes. That took 13,000 years. Just consider the shape of the world, the state of the world in the year AD 1492, when Columbus sailed to the New World. At that time, and the Americas were occupied by people with stone or wooden tools, and Aboriginal Australians were hunter-gatherers and tribal organizations. Of course, the empires with the steel tools and nasty germs and horses exterminated or drove out the tribes with the stone and wooden tools. So why is it that in 1492, Australia and the New World had stone and wooden tools and Eurasia had steel tools? That's the result of developments since 11,000 BC, not because of any biological differences among the peoples themselves. It's because of effects of the environment, namely that the Eurasian continent had far more domesticable wild plant and animal species, that east-west axis, and it's a bigger continent and it's less isolated. Often I still hear the objection, well, that's nice speculation, but I want an experiment to prove it. Is there any experiment, if the Aboriginal Australians could have been brought to Europe 13,000 years ago, can you prove to me they would have gone out and conquered the world, not the Europeans? History did not give us that experiment. History gave us an experiment close to it. If you want to think that Europeans are superior, history did the following experiment. 1,000 years ago, there were Germanic people living in Scandinavia and Holland and England, And some of those Germanic people stayed home in Holland and Scandinavia, and others of them emigrated to Greenland with their iron tools and their advanced societies. And in Greenland, they encountered the Inuit, the Eskimos, with their stone tools and tribal organization. And 500 years later, who do you think had won that competition between the Europeans and the Inuit? 500 years later, the Europeans were extinct in Greenland. Greenland was once again firmly in the hands of the stone tool using Inuit, and yet the relatives of those Germanic peoples who emigrated to Greenland and failed there, their relatives were staying home in Holland and England and developing the world's great art traditions and the world's great literature and the world's great mercantile traditions, all a matter of different. Well, these are big questions at the interface between history and biology, linguistics, and genetics. I promise that I'll summarize everything about history for you in 40 minutes, and that unfortunately means that there are many important factors in world history that I haven't had time to discuss in 40 minutes, but that I do discuss in my book, Zwarden, Pardon, and Ziek de Kiemen. For example, I've told you today little or nothing about the distribution of domesticable plant species, to which I devote three chapters of Zwarden, Pardon, etc. I haven't told you anything about the precise way in which the development of writing and technology and government and organized religion depended on agriculture and herding. That gets three chapters of Zwarden, Pardon. I haven't discussed with you the fascinating the differences within Eurasia between the histories of China, India, the Near East, and Europe. That I wrap up, summarize in 9 pages of Zwarden, Pardon. I haven't discussed the effects of individuals, the so-called great man theory, and I haven't discussed cultural differences unrelated to the environment on human history, which gets 2 pages of Zwarden, Pardon. But it's now time to summarize for you the overall meaning of this whirlwind tour through human history with its unequally distributed guns and germs. About 15 years ago, I stopped being just a sober academic writing boring things for other academics and tried to convey something of the excitement of science to a broad public. I quickly encountered an occupational hazard of the academic who would like to address the public. And that occupational hazard is to encounter a television reporter or a newspaper reporter or a radio interviewer who will say to me things like the following: Mr. Diamond, I know that you've devoted the last 5 years of your life to reading hundreds or thousands of books and articles and condensing it all into this 420-page book. But, Mr. Diamond, please remember, our listeners and our viewers and our newspaper readers are busy people. So please, Mr. Diamond, would you summarize everything about history in one sentence? And I've learned how to do it. The broadest pattern of history, namely the differences between human societies on different continents, seems to me to be attributable to differences among continental environments and not at all to biological differences among peoples themselves. One sentence. But once you've said that one sentence, you can usually slip in another sentence. And so I go on, in particular, Miss Reporter, the availability of wild plant and animal species suitable for domestication and the ease with which those species could spread without encountering unsuitable climates contributed decisively to the varying rates of rise of agriculture and herding, which in turn contributed decisively to the varying rates of rise of human population numbers, population densities, and food surpluses, which in turn contributed decisively to the varying rates of rise of epidemic infectious diseases, writing, technology, and political organization. Now, as a biologist hired by the University of California to practice laboratory experimental science, I know well that many of my scientist colleagues are inclined to dismiss such historical interpretations as unprovable speculation because they are not founded on what scientists consider to be the hallmark of science, namely replicated laboratory experiments carried out by little men wearing white laboratory coats. The same objection can be raised against any of the historical sciences. And those historical sciences include astronomy, evolutionary biology, geology, and ecology. And the objection can, of course, be raised against the whole field of history. to the other social sciences. That's the reason why we are uncomfortable about considering history as a science. It's classified as a social science, which is considered not quite scientific. But let's remember that the goal of science is to acquire knowledge. In science, we seek knowledge by whatever methodologies are available and appropriate. There are many fields that nobody hesitates to consider sciences, even though in those fields replicated laboratory experiments would be impossible or illegal or immoral. For example, an astronomer can't understand star evolution by manipulating some stars, let's turn off Betelgeuse today and turn off Capella and Aldebaran tomorrow, while keeping Sirius and Procyon as unmanipulated controls. And we can't start and stop, geologists cannot start and stop ice ages. If you want to understand why Holland is flat, you can't do the experiment of starting up some new glaciers and watching Holland get flattened and then melting your glaciers. And similarly, paleontologists cannot understand dinosaurs by experimenting with designing a new set of dinosaurs and then exterminating them again. Nevertheless, astronomers and geologists and paleontologists have succeeded in gaining considerable insight into these historical sciences by other means. So we should surely be able to understand human history, because introspection and preserved writings give us far more insight into the ways of past humans than we shall ever have into the ways of past dinosaurs. For that reason, I'm optimistic that we can eventually arrive at convincing explanations for these broadest patterns of human history. Thank you.